You are listening to a podcast of the London Irish Business Society's event, Ireland's Oil and Gas Potential, Overhyped or Undersold. This event was hosted in the Embassy of Ireland, Great Britain, in London on May 15th, 2014. The expert panel of speakers included Bernard Looney, COO of Production, BP, Tony O'Reilly Jr., CEO of Providence Resources, and Minister Fergus O'Dowd, TD and Minister of State for the New Era Project. The session was moderated by and opens with Professor Nick Butler, Chair of the King's Policy Institute, King's College, London.
Your Excellency, Minister, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. It's a great pleasure to be here. Privileged to be invited to chair this event. As an Englishman, I feel daunted by the amount of talent in the room, and that is just Bernard. I'm not going to say a great deal. I'm here to learn too. I write about energy and power for the Financial Times, as Jill said, and I'm struck by how much is changing across the energy business right around the world. More than most people realise. I think that is partly driven by policy, which is encouraging development in areas which otherwise would not be economic. That's particularly renewables, but also nuclear and other parts of the energy business. But even more fundamentally than policy, the big change is coming through technology, through things that are being made possible by technical change discovered usually in universities, sometimes in companies, but which can be applied everywhere across the world very quickly because of globalization. And the real advantage of big companies as well as small companies is that big companies can take a technical advance that is made in the US or the UK or anywhere else, and increasingly in China actually, and apply it right around the world within 12, 24 months. And that really drives a lot of changes that we're seeing. What the technology is doing is changing the industry's view of geology. I think we now understand much more about the Earth and where the resources might be than we did 10 or 20 years ago. And we know where to drill. It's possible to drill with much greater precision and to avoid a lot of the dry wells and the costs that that used to employ. And it's also changing, the technology is changing the economics of what is recoverable. You used to have fields of a certain size before they were worth developing. The technology has now made it possible with horizontal drilling and targeted drilling and different production techniques to capture oil and gas from much smaller pools. And that, again, is changing the way the industry sees itself. I see those changes. I look at what's happening around the world. You see it in the Mediterranean, where the industry is taking a completely new view of the geology there. Across Africa, particularly North and East Africa, and across Europe. And partly that's shale, but it's also a rediscovery of some of the areas of conventional oil and gas. There is a great new gas find in southern Germany, which has not really had great publicity yet, that people had just not realised was there. Now, I don't know about Ireland, which is why I wanted to come and to listen. I think that the geology has always looked prospective, but the economics have never looked right. And that is a very simplistic view, and I want to see by the end of the evening if that is still the case. I hope it's got better. So we're going to have three speakers, starting with the minister, and then we'll have some open questions. I'll start the questions and then throw it open to you to ask more. Thank you. Minister.
I'm just delighted to be here in London, and I said last time I was here I was at the Irish Post evening where we met with Michael Flatley of among other dignitaries, and it's a different venue. That was the Dorchester. Here we're in your home tonight, Ambassador. It's great to be here. So I just want to say that it's a great pleasure to be here and to meet so many young Irish people. And just to say, just very briefly, comparing previous generations, my generation, when it came over here, it came in the, you know, it came in to Holyhead, the 6-hour trip by train, the trying to get somewhere in Euston Station, trying to link through the GA, through the Irish pub network, and so on, to get a job, to move on in life. And the Irish made significant contribution through all our generations to, you know, for many, many years, for many centuries with the United Kingdom. We found great homes here and great, great futures. And I'm particularly impressed by the young people here tonight. Young people, 20s, 30s, and so on, who are fighting their way through their, you know, through this mass of how to get on in life, how to get a job, how to succeed. And to succeed in London is really a tremendous place, being the international city that it is. And the challenges that you face as an Irish ethnic group here, intermingling with each other and with all your guests here tonight, it's really a huge change that's coming about. So we're here tonight to talk about Ireland's oil and gas potential. I know, Professor, I think I have 7 minutes, which is, I suppose, long enough for a politician, maybe too long for a lot of you. But I think it's just about right for me. So I want to say that when the questions and answers come, I'll be very succinct and to the point. And anything that's difficult, I'll pass on. And my Kieran O'Hoban from our department is here as well. Just by the way, he's our chief principal officer dealing with all of this, and his knowledge is phenomenal, and I want to acknowledge his presence. So really, what's it all about? 7 minutes is short time, so I just put it to you this way. Last year, as a Minister of State, I flew in a helicopter out to a place called Dún Chuain, which was a site picked by ExxonMobil off the coast of Ireland, where they hoped they would find oil or gas. We travelled, I think, to the very limit of the helicopter trip. I think it is the previous effort to get there wasn't able to proceed because some ship had got into trouble off sea and they had to use the base for something else. But it was a long trip and it was an exciting trip. It was great. I don't know how many people here have ever been on a platform, an oil platform, out in the middle of the sea, out in the deepest ocean, out in a very, very difficult terrain, literally, geologically and in terms of the environment. But the wish and the hope was there in me and all of us that they would strike oil, that they would strike gas, that it would be successful. Now, the company spent something like 150 million euros developing that their potential there, and the science and the knowledge that they got is theirs to speak about. But we want more and more people like that off our shore. Our job in government is to do exactly as what you said, is to get to encourage more companies to go out, more companies to invest, and to set the pace for them in terms of the conditions and the financial rewards that there will be for them and for us should they succeed. So just to give you a few brief points. Ireland's offshore is huge. It's 700,000 square kilometres. That's a hell of a lot of area. So where do you, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. Everybody says, yes, there are active hydrocarbon systems off our country, off our coast. The thing is to find the right one and to find it as quickly as possible. We've had exploration for nearly half a century. We've had only 4 commercial gas discoveries, plus a number of other oil and gas discoveries. We've had a long exploration history, yet we're relatively unexplored. What do we do? How can we attract more companies in? We've had something like 158 exploration and appraisal wells. Compared to the United Kingdom, 4,000, Norway 1,200. And in the last 10 years, we've only had 10 wells, which is a very small number indeed. The debate goes on. What should we do? How can we develop our potential? Press statements by smaller oil companies can sometimes be over-optimistic. And I'm not talking about you, Tony, by the way. This can create, this is what the department wrote, by the way. This can create a misconception that significant commercial discoveries have been made or are imminent, often in instances where no decision has actually been made to drill at all. Estimates of our potential resources, like, you know, every day in this business you meet people who say, well, look, you're giving it all away and, you know, this, you know, all our resources are gone and you're doing the wrong thing and so on. So what we're trying to do is to bring a dose of reality into all of this, to bring about the changes that we need. We've had some very positive indicators. We had an Atlantic margin licensing round where we open up our western seaboard to companies that want to come in and have a look. We had a look by 13 companies in 2011, And 11 of those are now converting to what we call a frontier exploration license. And over the next number of years for that period, there will be a drilling option. There is a drilling commitment. We have new companies coming in. We have Cairn, we have Cosmos, we have Australian company Woodside. Following on the positive outcome of Barry Roe in 2012, there has been a significant increase also in interest, as Tony knows, in exploring in the Celtic Sea. 2013 saw the highest ever level of new seismic data acquisition in any one year of Ireland's offshore. So what does that mean? It means that companies have spent millions of euros, tens of millions of euros, going over the geology, going out to sea, getting a boat, using seismic, which is sound, to bounce waves off the geology to find out to see what might be under there. So we've had huge interest in that, and it continues this year. There were five 3D surveys, one 2D, and so on. We've had 13,500 kilometres of 2D seismic and 7,000 of 3D. So that's really great information. I don't know if people here in the oil industry, that means that they know now they have a good roadmap of what might be there. There are challenges to maintain. There are issues to be dealt with. One of them I'll just talk about briefly because I'm conscious of the time. And politicians usually have a fellow that rings the bell in the doll. I just want to say this, that putting all this science out there, the companies are really, really interested. I've traveled to different countries. I've been to the United States recently. I've been to Houston. I've been to Dallas. I've met companies that are interested in coming to Ireland. And the key thing is that they know that there's certainty about their investment. There is certainty about what the terms are going to be. That there's not going to be retrospective analysis or retrospective findings against them financially. That the roadmap is there, that the future is there, and it's bright and it's clear. One of the big things we're doing, and it's imminent, our report is imminent in relation to our terms. We're looking at our terms again, and we'll have a transparent, full account and debate on all of that shortly, so that if you're coming to Ireland, yes, you'll know what the terms are, and you know exactly what you'll be letting yourself in for. But like we know that if you're an investor coming in here to our country, that you want to know that the deal is good, that it's there, that the chances that you're taking are measured in the benefit that you get and we get as well. We're not giving away our oil and gas, we're not giving away our hydrocarbons, but we want you to take the risk and we want to reward you for that risk because we want to use that oil and gas and the benefits that flow from it for the benefit of our country and our economy. So I suppose that it's a progressive, constructive, science-based project that we have. And the last thing I'll say is that one of the major studies we've done in Ireland is that we've looked at the geology offshore and we're comparing it. They've done a retrospective plate reconstruction. What they've done is the scientists, we've commissioned a major survey along with people in Canada, Newfoundland in Canada, when millions and millions of years ago the land masses were together and in geological time they separated. But what we've discovered is that the oil wells that are presently finding off the coast of Canada in geological time, they match in our map in significant respects what that geology was like on our side of that divide before it happened. And we're very hopeful and very interested in all of that. We had a conference in Dublin early last year where we had over 200 interested parties at. So I'll just leave it this way. We're progressive. We're reviewing our terms. We're increasing the scientific knowledge. We're an open economy with transparent dealing to do. We want people to invest, and we want you here tonight to go away knowing that we're open for business, and we want to do it, and I'm delighted to hear our speakers and to listen to your questions and answers afterwards. Thank you.
Minister, thank you very much. It's now my pleasure to introduce Bernard Looney. I've known Bernard for some time. He is a remarkable person. He taught me when we worked together a great many things, but the only thing he didn't teach me was how to make him speak for only 7 minutes. Bernard.
Thank you, Nick. Minister, Ambassador, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Dívida Cóirde. My thanks to Darren and Jill for and the London Irish Business Society for inviting me here this evening. It's my great pleasure to be on Irish soil without having to navigate Terminal 1, which is always fun. I'm Irish. I grew up in a small farm outside of Kenmare, and that makes me a Kerryman. Any Kerry people in the audience tonight? Very good, excellent. A few of us made it. I lived in America for many years, and hence the accent. But when I was in the States, people would always ask me what Kerry County was like. And I explained that in Britain, they tell Irish jokes, of course, at least they used to. And in Ireland, they tell Kerryman jokes. So that puts us at the bottom of the pile, so to speak, and it helped the Americans understand the psyche. But with that as a backdrop, let me start by saying that BP, for whom I work, has had a long history in oil and gas in Ireland. We spotted our first well in the Fastnet Basin in 1976. And over the years, we held equity in some 62 blocks and participated in the drilling of about 17 exploration and appraisal wells, with 15 where we were the operator. And we left in 1989. And in the words of our then director of Irish exploration, a guy called Dr. Brian Lovell, we left a whole lot wiser, but with rather less money. Our campaign back then, over that period, 17 wells, cost us $120 million. And we'd be lucky, and in fact, as the minister said, Dunquin, a single well today, cost about well in excess of that amount. So things have moved on. As we begin a discussion tonight on the prospects in Ireland, Darren asked that I focus my remarks on BP's view of the industry from a global perspective. Without fail, three questions usually rise to the top of any such discussion. First, will the world need more energy in the future, or will efficiency play its part? Secondly, is the age of fossil fuels over, the question of sustainability? And third, is there enough oil and gas, or have we passed the point of the so-called peak oil? To help answer these questions, I'm going to refer to a study that our economists produce every year called the BP Energy Outlook. And with regard to the first question on demand, we forecast demand for energy will grow by 1.5% per year between now and 2035. And when you do the math, that in aggregate amounts to about 40%, are the equivalent of adding another China and another United States combined to the world by 2035. And that increase of 40% comes despite a fall of 36% over that time period in energy intensity. And we measure that as the amount of energy we require to create a unit of GDP. It's as we become more efficient and China moves from an era of industrialization to a services-based economy. The bottom line is that the world will continue to demand more and more energy into the future. Which takes us to the second question. What does it mean for fossil fuels? Our review says that by 2035, a full 4/5, or 81% to be precise, of the world's energy will be supplied by oil, gas, and coal. And that's down only 5% from today's numbers. And for the first time since the Industrial Revolution, no single fuel will be dominant. In fact, oil, gas, and coal will each converge on having 27% share at that point in time. Now, you might say that as an oil and gas man and as an oil and gas company, that's a projection is rather self-serving, but as many of you well know, other studies point to exactly the same conclusion. So for now, oil and gas looks like it's going to be around for quite some time. And finally, to the is there enough oil and gas in the world question. I think without doubt, the shale revolution in North America has put paid to that concern. I don't think there's any greater example in the world of where markets and technology come together to make a massive step change in what's going on. And the result is that North America could be self-sufficient in oil and gas within the next decade. And that was unthinkable just a few years ago. I think the peak oil theory has peaked, so to speak. So looking more globally, we see a similar picture. Increasingly, the issue is not quantity of resource, how much is out there. It's about accessibility and, quite frankly, affordability. Future reserves are sitting in deeper, hotter, higher pressure, and more hostile surroundings. And at BP, for example, we're leading the development of 20,000 pounds per square inch technology, production equipment. We're trying to develop that so that we can progress these new frontiers. And ultimately, that is where companies like us can play a major role. But it does cost more money. And in the period of time between 2005 and 2012, major oil and gas companies like ourselves, our annual combined capital that we invest in the business more than doubled from $59 billion to over $130 billion during that time period. And then the world changed. At BP, we had the tragedy that was the Deepwater Horizon accident in the Gulf of Mexico. And what started for us as a divestment program designed to shore up the balance sheet evolved into a core part of our strategy. As we said earlier, as Jill mentioned, we're focused, as many in our industry, on value over volume and doing fewer things well. And in many ways, driven by shareholders' increasing and growing impatience with promises from our industry of future growth, the industry has followed. And financial discipline, as Jill says, has become the mantra, and we're all reining in on our investments around the world. So to come to a close, what might this all mean for Ireland? The reality is that there is much more competition today for the investment dollar. Inevitably, when we face choices of where do we spend our exploration budget, we're drawn to conversations about above-the-ground factors and below-the-ground factors. On the former, I think the Minister said it well, we look at the long-term economic stability of the country, the regulatory frameworks, the task, the tax, and the other business incentives available, and the availability of local skills. But as he quite rightly pointed out, consistency, stability, and predictability are the things that we look to when we are making investments that for us will span multiple decades. And on the latter, the below the ground, what's down there? There's no doubt that Ireland does hold some intrigue. As preparation for tonight, I sat down with one of our exploration directors and we talked about the three principal basins, the North Celtic Sea, the Porcupine Basin, and the Rockall Trough. And just taking one of them, the Rockall Trough, it is one of the largest unexplored basins in the planet. It is larger than the island of Ireland alone. These are no small facts. But it's not easy. It's remote. Dunquin, I think, is 200 kilometers offshore. The Rockall Trough is up to 400 kilometers offshore. It's in water depths of up to 1,500 meters. And it's hostile. In February 2000, a research vessel encountered the largest wave ever recorded by scientific instruments in the open ocean, with an individual wave that measured 95 feet or 29 meters. And to top it all, if you'll excuse the pun, it is overlaid with basalt, which makes interpretation of the seismic images that the minister talked about exceptionally challenging. But that's what we do. That's what companies like BP do. This is the sort of area where we find we can be distinctive. So how will we decide? Well, it's simply a question of whether the rewards justify the risks. And the reality is that given the track record in Ireland, Irish exploration does carry real risk. In the end, we can debate Ireland's potential until the cows come home. But ultimately, it can only be determined by putting holes in the ground. Whether BP drills those holes or not remains to be seen. And with that, I shall hand you back to Nick. Thank you for listening. Gurv Míle Maith Agat.
Thank you, Bernard, and thank you for sticking to the time. Now it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Tony O'Reilly.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Good thing about being the last speaker is they've done all the hard work, so I can just fill in a few of the gaps maybe that talking about a few points on the global industry and what it means in the context of Ireland, our experience in Ireland and why actually we're in Ireland. But when I'm talking about our experience in Ireland, I'm also talking about our fellow companies in Ireland, the smaller junior independents who play a key role in opening up Ireland, so the Fastnets, the Lansdowns, other companies. And then I've been handed a poison chalice, especially with the minister and the PAD official, Ciarán Óibín here, to give a few comments on what the Irish government should do on policy. So let me first start by just talking about the global industry, because it does have ramifications for Ireland, because it is a truly global industry. And what you're seeing in the world now, and I think Bernard would agree, is you're seeing companies are going after scale. They're going after big resource plays. So when they're looking at Ireland, they've got to see, do they see that potential? Secondly, every part of the world is now open for business. There's no place you can't go. And so that means there's increased competition. So that has implications in terms of the ability to do business, the fiscal regime, the emergence of NOCs, who have become big players going for, in a sense, that resource nationalism, trying to control the hydrocarbon molecules, be it gas or oil, that has implications again. And again, that should be something that policymakers should be thinking about, particularly looking out towards the Far East. And then obviously, as Bernard said, cost overruns and the CapEx element in the industry, it has become a very, very big factor for the industry, where everybody is curtailing their CapEx. And so what that means for the junior companies is that we're now having to think outside the box as to how we can develop our projects, not necessarily relying all the time on the big companies coming in and writing the big checks, because they're just not writing them anymore. I was asked to say, why Ireland? Well, first of all, we're Irish. And there was a guy called Tony O'Reilly about 34 years ago who started a company. And he started a journey, which many other people followed, which was basically he had a simple thesis that, you know, the English can't have all the oil. They must have left a little bit for the Irish. So we went on that journey. We had a company called Atlantic Resources. We spent the 80s drilling lots of wells. Unfortunately, every time we drilled fields and found things, we kept on making them smaller, not bigger, which is not a good model to follow. Our focus has always been the Irish offshore. We've drilled 17 wells or been involved in 17 wells. And, you know, that is, I think, shows a real commitment. That's probably expenditure of over $750 million by us and our partners exploring on the Irish offshore. As to the tonight's theme, which is Ireland, is it overhyped? And some people have accused me of being a little bit of a hype merchant, or undersold. I would just simply say it's underexplored. There have not been enough wells drilled. You've got an area which is about six times the size of the North Sea. And, you know, basically, there's only been 138 exploration wells drilled and about 28 appraisal wells. And just to give you the context, the well that was referred to earlier on, the Dunquin well, which Exxon drilled, which was actually one of our original projects, and we were involved in it, that was the first well in a basin the size of the whole North Sea, the first well. So again, it just proves what a significant area it is, and we need more investment in 3D, we need more investment in drilling dollars. Obviously, as I said, you know, our experience has been a positive one. We've had, in recent years, we launched a multi-basin drilling program, and we've had some success in the Celtic Sea with our Barrier Row discovery. And again, we're hoping to build on that, and we're hoping that that garners a lot of international interest to come to Ireland, because we need those international partners in Ireland. They don't just bring the money. They bring the technical capabilities, because Ireland is a challenging area. Some people say, well, what's different now with a guy called O'Reilly trying to sell the Irish offshore to a guy 30 years ago? And there are big differences. The four pillars of infrastructure that we now have in Ireland, which we never had, you know, pipeline infrastructure in Ireland, the interconnection to the UK. You've obviously got technology, and that's, you know, affected every business in the world. It's no different in the oil and gas industry. You've got a price regime, which is positive and is sort of consistent. You could look at the forward curve and have a positive view that the price deck is going to stay up. And importantly, you have a fiscal regime which has been designed to attract that inward investment. So all those elements coming together, which probably worked against the successful exploration or commercialization of hydrocarbon opportunities offshore Ireland, are now working in our favor. The key point I always try to say to people is, you know, it is about little companies like us, Fastnet, Lansdowne, the Irish companies who get the licenses, who will do, in a sense, the heavy lifting, taking the assets to a certain stage and then leveraging in the international partners who can really put their capital to work and help us develop our oil and gas industry. And that is key. So any future policy, and I'm directing this to you, the Minister, make sure we keep opening the doors so that BP will come into Ireland and other companies will come into Ireland, because we need their technical and financial capabilities. How do you do that from a policy point of view? You know, one of the things I've been harping on about, I think it's starting to get some support, is an IDA-type initiative for the oil and gas industry. It's not just bringing the oil companies, it's the service companies, it's putting their offices in Ireland, it's all the benefits. When you look at Aberdeen and you realize what a phenomenally successful area it is now, and 45 years ago it was a fishing village, why can't we have that in Ireland? We've already demonstrated an enormous capability as a country of attracting that foreign direct investment in keeping it. So I think hopefully the IDEA have heard the message we've been trying to convey from the Irish Offshore Operators Association to really push for some people being disciples going out there and really trying to assist the industry. Tax, I've been asked to comment on tax. Please leave it the way it is. It's grand. It's grand. We need an industry to start. I think and Minister Rabbit said it quite rightly. When we get to a stage where we have Norwegian-style oil business and gas business, we'll have tax rates that are more commensurate with that. But right now, we need an open-door policy to attract the inward investment. The only other comment I would say before I sign off is we need to ensure that CORB never happens again, because that has probably, in all my dealings and all the conversations I've had all over the world, has probably been the biggest black mark for the Irish offshore. The geology, challenging. The fiscal regime, okay, it's good. But then they're saying, hey, if you find something, can you actually develop it? So we need to make sure in policies and at grassroots level that we don't have a repeat of CORB. And then finally, one last ask is that, and the minister's referred to it, we have a licensing round that's going to be happening in September 2015. There is huge interest in Ireland, and it's great to see. And I think, the Irish regulator and the PAD is to be congratulated on what they've done in promoting the Irish offshore around the world. I think the only thing I would add to that is let's make it more regular. Let's do it on an annual or a biannual basis, because big companies plan a long time ahead. So they need to ensure that they can build the Irish plan into their overall plans. So those are my comments. Thank you all very much.
Tony, thank you. I'm now going to ask a couple of questions and then I'll throw it open to the floor. I'd like to ask the two people from the industry.
I've been reading recently The History of the North Sea, which is a great book. It's a rather expensive book by a man called Alex Kemp, who's a professor at Aberdeen, who's lived his whole life through the story of the North Sea. And he starts off by talking about the years and years and years when nothing happened, and when every obstacle, he didn't quite quote the waves, but the rough conditions, the fact that people didn't believe that platforms could stand up and stay up, that people could be transported out there safely, and the economics. All those things put the North Sea off for most of the 1960s. I'd like to hear from both of you exactly what combination of circumstances it is that you think would make either the big companies or the small companies go into Ireland now. Is it tax? You've said not. Do you agree, Bernard? Is it some other regulatory change? What would make you two go and put a very significant amount of money to do the drilling that you both said was needed before this can really get going?
Well, I'm already doing the drilling, so in a sense, I'm already a card-carrying member. But I think it's having certainty on the fiscal regime. I think that's a key thing. I mean, the industry is all about risk. It's all about managing risk, and the industry hates the uncertainty of any aspect of their business. And whilst they've said that it'll only be for terms going forward, I think clarity on that is important, and I'm glad to hear the minister say that that's, it will be clarified in the near future. I think probably the big thing for companies is to see, and Bruno could talk to this probably better than I can, because I'm a little company that wants to be a big company, but, I think it's about applying new technology, new thoughts to an area, and I think the initiative taken by the government in acquiring 2D, the companies acquiring 3D, that's all good stuff, because we're going to get a better visualization of what lays beneath. Because, really, as we said, it's untested. And then I think certainty in terms of if you do find something, that you can be assured that the planning and permitting process is robust and clear, so that there aren't, as I said earlier on, the CORB issues. So I think those probably are the three points that I'd highlight.
Yeah, I think, as I look at what we've done over the last two or three years, we've entered Uruguay, the Great Australian Bight in Australia, and the Ceduna Basin, Nova Scotia, Namibia, lots of places. Why haven't we been in Ireland? Which is, I think, your question, Nick. And the reality is that the geology is tough. It does have to start with the resource. No resource, no oil and gas business, no arguments over who gets what. And the geology is tough. The three basins have unique challenges, quite unique from a geological perspective. And when you couple that with the track record, when you couple that with, I think, your report by PwC, Tony said, one in 32 wells in history have been successful. And you then take the cost of drilling one of these wells that could be between $200 and $300 million, you have in front of you a choice. And it's a simple economic choice at the end of the day about risk and reward. And it simply hasn't floated to the top of our list. And there's no doubt, I agree with Tony, that technology is the thing that's going to unlock this. And it's one of the things that we feel we can do rather well, seismic imaging, seismic interpretation. That is the thing that's going to make the difference. The Porcupine Basin has only 21 wells drilled in it. And they were mostly drilled in the 70s. And they have what's called two-dimensional seismic. What you just described with the new seismic that's been shot and the largest survey ever, that's going to help transform not what's down there, because what's there is there, but it's our understanding of what's there. And it is where we come into play and where we can make that judgment that says whether the risk and the reward are commensurate. And to date, that hasn't worked for us. We'll see what the future holds.
So are you saying, Bernard, that the big companies have the breakthrough technology, but they don't have the appetite for something that is at this point on the risk curve?
No, I think we do, and Tony said it well as well. It is about scale. And that is where, for a company like a BP or a Statoil, we do look for the very big fields. It's what we do, it's what we've done over the years. And that's where something like the Rockall Trough, which is, as I said, has massive potential scale. The reality is it's difficult, it's tough. So it's not that Providence doesn't have technology. They've got lots of technology, they've got lots of know-how. John O'Sullivan, your chief explorer, is one of the best in the industry. But we do bring that international experience, we do bring the financial capacity, and we do bring the learning from opening up basins around the world in Angola, in the days you were with us, Nick, in Azerbaijan, in the Gulf of Mexico, and that's what we want to do. Tony, you want to come in?
Yeah, I just want to say one thing, lest we think that, you know, it's just a few little Irish companies. We actually do have big operators in Ireland. We have Shell, we have Statoil, we have Petronas, we have Eni, we have Repsol, we have ExxonMobil. You're the odd one out, yep. So maybe later on, corner him and get him to put his money into Ireland. But,
so far, so
you know,
good,
what we do need is more investment by them. We need more investment, more drilling by those companies as well as the junior companies. But, you know, there is interest in Ireland, so let's not be too negative about it.
All right. My second question is on the onshore. You both talked about the offshore and the potential there and the challenges. Do you see any potential for shale gas or tight oil in Ireland?
Well, gas was discovered, I think, in the north over 50 years ago. And from what I know, the Larne Mayo Basin is an extension, Nick, of the Lower Cretaceous in the North Sea. Fracking's been done in Ireland in the early 2000s. There are small companies that are engaged in acquiring new licenses. I think you're doing some work, Minister. You no doubt want to comment on the hurdles that are put in place and the checks and balances to make sure that that's done well. But the extension of that basin in the southern North Sea, the Lower Carboniferous, does offer some real potential. And it's certainly transformed the situation in the United States. The same as potentially about to happen in the UK, and I guess that potential exists in Ireland.
Jamie? There's no doubt geologically there's huge potential. I have my reservation. I mean, I got my gray hair by running an Irish mining company for 15 years. So I think, you know, it, being onshore, local farmers, small land parcels, it creates a lot more issues. Obviously, the success in North America, Canada, and the United States is you've got huge tracts of land, which is easier to manage, and landmen come and buy thousands of acres. Just it'll be a little bit more difficult to probably address that in Ireland. And there is also the other element, which is in America and Canada, there's clear compensation structure, royalties, etc. We don't necessarily have, and I know the minister will say we do have a royalty regime probably, but I don't think it's clearly communicated as being equivalent to what could be achieved in other parts of the world. And that may be an issue for local farm landowners in particular, who would be, their consent would be required. Even though the minister owns the minerals, the oil and the gas minerals, obviously if you're a landowner, you do have certain rights. And it's just a question of getting the compensation structure right for that. So I think it can be done, but it'll be a little bit more challenging than being offshore.
But to give you an idea of how difficult the issue is, those of you that have ever been to County Leitrim or County Fermanagh know the beautiful countryside, the lakes, the recreation, the amenities that are there, and the views of those communities on fracking, or what they think is fracking, what the media tell them fracking is. So I think I recently went to the United States, and I spoke to the author, one of the people who's actually writing the American report into fracking, right? And I've met with them. I met with two of those gentlemen, and we looked at a fracking site in a very urban area, right beside a school, actually. And I'm aware of the science. I'm aware of the technology. I'm aware the technology is and will continue to change. I'm aware of the significant opposition there is in Ireland to fracking, very serious, very significant. And the fact that it is not always based on science. And one of the key points is transparency in America isn't there in terms of whether or not all of those use carcinogenic chemicals when they're fracking the rock. The question of conservation of the water table, and there's huge issues there. And what we've done in Ireland is this, that it'll be about 2016 before we'll have the report. We've commissioned a report, North and South, the Northern Ireland Administration, the Southern Government are agreed that this report must be done. It will be done by the EPA. It will cost millions of euros. It will look at all of the science, all of the facts, and this has to be about facts. I think this is to establish what the facts are, what is best practice, what works, what doesn't work, why countries have banned it, why countries allow it, what's the best evidence in Europe, what are the regulations in terms of the environment and so on. So I'd say the jury is not out on the benefit of shale gas. There's no doubt about that. It's transformed the American economy. But the jury of the Irish public have to be convinced of the political system that if it's done safely, environmentally safely, without polluting the environment, the water table, all of those issues are critical, absolutely critical. I wouldn't underestimate them. And the volumes of water that are used, I don't know if anybody's looking at the New York Times recently about the issues in relation to water in America and fracking. It's a huge issue. And whether we're capable of sustaining that and protecting our environment. So that's, I don't think that gives you clarity, it gives you certainty of the knowledge in good time by 2016. I've identified the environmental issues, the community and political concerns. And I say when that report comes out, it will inform us clearly as to what the state of play is at that time. But finally, I would say this, that I think it's down to the technology, actually, to be honest, because when you look at a site that has been fracked, right, post the event, you see very little, in fact. And a lot of the American operations that you see in terms of the, I suppose, the political representation of the industry showed destroyed landscapes, destroyed communities, and so on. Now, I haven't seen that in America. I didn't see it I was in Pennsylvania, so I didn't see it there. But people fear that it's there. And I would say as the technology improves, and fracking means effectively, if I've got it right, you're the professionals, it's sort of underground parallel lines through the rock. In other words, it doesn't, you go in at one point and then you go in a circular drilling right across under, what, 2 or 3 kilometres down or whatever. And I say as the ability to increase the length of those fracking distances, if you could frack today and go, say, 20 kilometres in all directions, that would be a different, an entirely different prospect, I would say,
in terms of environmental impact than it is presently. And I think that's the sort of technology that will change people's views. But it is a very serious issue, and it's one which, obviously, I put a lot of thought into, as you have as well, and I'm sure your people...
If I could just add, Nick, I do think... it's clear that you've put a lot of thought into it, and I think it's worth it. I think I've been, like you have, I've been to Colorado, East Texas, Wyoming. I've been to our operations in these places. I've seen what it can do to the local economy. I'm reversing roles with Tony here a little bit. But I think this is worth fighting for, and it is actually about something that Ireland has stood for all its life, and that is about education. We have got to get the facts on the table. We have got to explain and educate to people. There's a huge amount of myth out there. Some of it is founded, a lot of it is unfounded. So I think, there was a study done here in the UK by the Royal Academy of Engineering, the Royal Society. I believe the Royal Society in Ireland has studied this topic, and now I think your review sounds like it will be conclusive in many ways. But let's get to the facts. Let's educate the public so that they don't have the fears that they understandably have, and let's see if we have something that could help transform the economy, because it certainly has done that in states and for the country in the United States, and we shouldn't let that opportunity go by in Ireland.
Thank you. Now we've time for a few questions from the floor. Who would like to start? Yes, please. Can you stand up and say who you are, and then we can hear.
Hi there. My name's Tim O'Riordan. I don't work in oil and gas, but I work for Aberdeen Asset Management, so I guess I can attest to how good oil and gas can be for a particular city. My question really is around risk and reward, which was discussed a couple of times this evening. As regards geopolitical risk, and Ukraine and Russia being quite a good example, I think, about how geopolitical circumstances and locations can arise. How far up the agenda is geopolitical risk for oil and gas companies at present time, and do you see that growing in future?
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Aberdeen is a great town. I lived there for many, many years, and I wouldn't put it in the geopolitical risk category. Other categories, perhaps, but we operate in difficult places around the world. That's the reality of our business. But one thing that we have to remind ourselves of all the time is that we're a very long-term investor. If you look at the situation in Egypt today, we're the largest foreign investor in Egypt. You could look at that situation and say, not a good place to be, difficult, challenging. But we've been in Egypt over 50 years as a company, and we've seen many civil wars, we've seen many issues over time. So political risk and geopolitical risk is clearly something that we have to take into account, and it's something that we debate. But ultimately, we're long-term investors. And oil and gas, aside from Ireland, doesn't end up being always in the most hospitable of environments. We work all around the world in different regimes with different risks. We've been in Libya. One of my colleagues here tonight lived in Tripoli for 10 months before he was evacuated out of there. But we have to take the long-term view, because the world doesn't just start and end in a year. And our investments are sometimes 50 years. We've just started a project in Oman, and we project cash flows through the end of the century from that investment. So it's a long-term game, and we have to look to the long-term. That doesn't say you ignore geopolitical issues, but it also means you don't get frightened by every headline you read in the newspaper, if that helps.
Gentlemen.
Hello, it's Paul Griffiths, Fastnet Oil and Gas. My question relates to technology, basically. I've listened to the guy saying that technology is the great leap forward, but I'd just like to be cautionary on that, because technology used in exploration, and I'm an exploration geologist, so I know about geology and geological risk. We've just drilled a well with BP and Kosmos in Morocco. And we've used all the technology available to us, 3D seismic, seismic calibration, AVO. And we've drilled that well for pretty much the same amount as BP spent between 76 and 89 in Ireland. Not in real terms, but same amount. And when BP were in Ireland, they discovered Connemara, 200 million barrels. They discovered a small gas field in the Celtic Sea, Galley Head. And that was done without technology. So my point is, technology is fine for appraisal and development, but you have to be very careful in exploration, and you have to use people skills combined with technology in exploration. And unfortunately, the industry seems to have moved away from people skills in exploration and concentrated on technology, which is why you see over the last 15, 18 months, a fairly disappointing history of exploration success on the African margin in terms of exploration wells, over-reliance on technology and exploration. And we don't like to see that in Ireland. We want to see people involved in exploration as well as technology. And I'd just like to see what the panel thinks on that.
Agree 100% with Paul. I mean, ultimately, people make businesses, any type of business, and it's no different than oil and gas business. I think you also need a bit of lady luck as well. That's why we're in this business. But, I do think certain aspects, and you'd agree, Paul, I think certain aspects of technology, for example, 3D, and the application, the reprocessing, that is a big step change. But still, getting the 3D, you've got to interpret the 3D. You still need that gray matter to be able to ascertain what you're going to do next.
Well, I think it's a great point. Our industry, like many industries, is a people industry. And we know the good people who have the instinct and the experience, and you know it when you see it. I'm a believer in technology. I've seen what subsolid imaging has done for us in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, where we are now able to image underneath 8,000 feet of salt, and we couldn't do that 10 years ago. But your point is right. If anybody walks out the door and thinks that technology is going to move from a 1 in 30 to a 1 in 1 success rate, that's not the case. It simply helps and is part of the equation. But ultimately, it's about know-how, and we call it know-how, but it is the combination of people, experience, intuition, and that piece of technology that can make the difference, that's going to unlock something. But you're absolutely right. It's not going to suddenly point to where everything is. It just helps.
I just want to respond to the previous question about geopolitical issues, and I just make a general observation. It's not about oil and gas per se. It's about energy. Like, we've got to get real about energy and about energy infrastructure. Whether it's renewable energy or whether it's, the grid coming through my parish or whatever, there's a huge issue about ownership of that by communities. And we need to ensure, I think, if the gas stops coming from Russia or whatever, we're in a real crisis. People's views will change as the people understand, how difficult, how expensive energy is becoming and how you deal with all of these other issues. And I think one of the biggest issues we have, and I don't know if other people agree with me, is educating the public about the benefit of energy structure, about the, about the grid, about exploration, about all of these issues, that it's all for us. It's not for those people called them. That people must have ownership. They must believe it's for their country, it's for their tax regime, it's for their community. There must be local benefit, there must be community benefit, there must be individual gain if it's going through your property and all those issues. But until we address all of those, honestly and openly as a society, and it's not just in Ireland, I think in the United Kingdom there are issues around renewable energy, I know in Germany there's issue around improving the grid. We're a lot of people have their eyes closed on this. And it's just a point I'd just like to make generally, that we need to sell that message better. We need to get all the facts out there and not the fiction. And we need just to be real as well about our future and about using all the resources, whatever they are, be it fracking, wind, wave, whatever it is, to get energy for the future. If it's done environmentally friendly, in a safe way, with community consent, with proper planning, with all of those things working together, well, then I think we'll make a lot of progress. And I just say that because I just feel that that's an issue that strikes me in a lot of places that I go to, and listen to communities that are, you know, that could make have put tremendous benefit if we could show them the way, basically.
One more question, then.
Thanks very much. Tony McDonald is my name. I have two questions, one serious, one less serious. The serious question is about renewables that the Minister mentioned there. Now, normally in Ireland, when we have, I suppose, a windfall industry, which oil and gas really is, because no matter how much you spend, when you discover something and it works, you make a lot of money from that one discovery. So that in itself is a windfall. So there's an argument there, I feel, for taxing that in a particular way. When we had a property industry, we used to build housing estates, and we used to compel the developers to give 20% to social housing. So I would argue that the Minister should consider compelling the energy industry to put a certain proportion of those royalties directly into renewable energies and low carbon and things like that, because oil and gas is one of those industries, and no one's really said this tonight, but it's very true, that actually taking the stuff out of the ground has a really, really detrimental environmental impact, and we need to mitigate that. So that's something I think that needs to be looked at in isolation maybe from anything else. The second question is maybe far more serious, Minister. We've had a dispute with the UK over Rockall for quite a number of years now. Rockall has been mentioned tonight, so I'm wondering, when are we going to send the FCA in our fishing boats to take the island back?
Minister, I think that's one for you. Well, Rockall, I think, there's a song about Rockall, I forget what the words were, but it's not on my vision right now, either for the FCA or any other crowd. I suppose the serious point you made, I think, really is about, you know, again, it's not for me to decide, but to me it seems an attractive proposition, you know, that you should look at when you have a regime, if you can encourage investment in alternative energy. But I think it would have to be consensual. I would think, you know, you couldn't, it would have to be, you know, part of somebody wanting to do it as opposed to forcing them to do it. But you have to have the mix anyway. We're on a European targets here in terms of renewable energy. But there is resistance to it, as we know, and that's a particular issue. But I go back to the point I made about geopolitics. As energy becomes more expensive, if there is political uncertainty in parts of the world, as there always is, and if it's nearer to us than it was before, that will change how people think as well. So I don't know if that's a helpful reply to you or not, but that's my response.
Thank you. Tony?
I was going to pick up on the windfall element, because as somebody who's been involved in, you know, directly or indirectly, 30 years offshore island, spent 750 million with our partners, we're spending 500 million now, and we haven't brought a drop ashore. That's no windfall, and it's going to take us hundreds and hundreds of millions, even billions. I mean, that's the level of investment required to bring that oil ashore. So I just caution the use of the word windfall, because it's going to take a lot more investment before we start to realize our hydrocarbon potential.
I think we've got time for one more. I see the staff behind the bar are getting very impatient. you have the last question.
Hi, Padraig Hanley. First question is to the Minister. This evening was mentioned about, you know, the CARB issues that were up there, and what are the government doing to make sure it doesn't happen again? And secondly, to Dr. O'Reilly, as a shareholder in Providence, how are you going to do to make sure that you don't have the same issues when trying to bring Barry Roe ashore?
I think just very quickly, the planning issues, since CARB started, there's what we call the Critical Infrastructure Bill has been passed. So there, all of the issues in relation to critical infrastructure are now fast-tracked through to a significant new part of our Planning Appeals Board. So it's a one-stop shop. It's much more scientifically focused in terms of the knowledge and the issues that they raise. There's also a preliminary process by which, if it is deemed that your proposal will fall into that area, that you have a preliminary period of time which you go to the board, you say, this is what I want to do, so you get an initial response, even though obviously it wouldn't limit you legally as to what you might do or might not do. So I think the other issue goes back again, and I just finish on this point, but it's an image I have in my mind when I went to CARB, right? I went to Mayo, and half of me is from Kerry, that's my other claim from Kerry. And it's a beautiful county, and Mayo is beautiful, it's much bigger. But you travel for ages right through a beautiful countryside to come to where the terminal is in CARB. And you find that there, 1,000 people have been employed there for a number of years. And there is no recession in that area. And it is a huge benefit to the community. And yet the political messages that came out of there, you know, were appalling, and as you have said, affected what people thought about Ireland, about investment. But all of that is over now, and I think that the planning process is much clearer, the safety issues are all there and more clearly defined. So notwithstanding the fact that if you did have a new CARB, and there would obviously be objectors to it, I think the planning process is much more focused, and there has been a number of legal challenges around that as well. So there's much greater clarity if and when the decision is made to go ahead. And I think that, you know, that obviously the benefits are enormous, and hopefully will happen sooner rather than later.
You have been listening to a podcast by the London Irish Business Society. We would especially like to thank the Ambassador Daniel Mulhall, the Embassy of Ireland Great Britain, and sponsors P-Cubed, NUI Galway, and Michael Page Banking and Financial Services for their ongoing support. You can read more about the Society, its events, and join for free membership at www.li-bs.co.uk.